You're listening to Sports Connections with David Smale, the show that brings you a fun and intimate look into connections throughout sports. Now here's your host, David Smale.
Jay Billis is America's preeminent college basketball analyst. The former Duke player and assistant coach has been part of ESPN's college basketball team since 1995. He does studio work. It's part of the lead game broadcast with Dan Shulman. Billis grew up in Southern California, where he averaged 23.5 and 13.5 rebounds per game as a senior in high school when he was named a consensus top 50 recruit. Chose to play his college ball at Duke, where he was a four-year starter, and in his senior year, he's part of Duke's 86 Final Four team. He was drafted in the fifth round of the NBA draft in 1986 by the Dallas Mavericks. He played 3 years in Europe before returning to Duke to become an assistant under Mike Krzyzewski. And in his 3 years on Coach K's staff, all because of Jay, I'm sure, Blue Devils went to three Final Fours and won two national championships. Billis was a good player, finishing his collegiate career scoring 1,062 points, pulling down 692 rebounds. But he's not afraid to laugh at his basketball abilities. My favorite Billis moment was about 8 or 10 years ago. ESPN's College Game Day was in Charlottesville, Virginia, for a big game between Duke and up-and-coming Virginia. About halfway through the show, Virginia brought out their all-time greatest player, former National Player of the Year, Ralph Sampson. As ESPN came out of a commercial break, they showed clips of Sampson dominating Duke back in the day. And most of those clips that they showed were against a floppy-haired Duke forward named Jay Billis. After they introduced Sampson, he was gracious in discussing Billis's defensive abilities. But then the funniest part happened. After another break, ESPN introduced UVA head coach Tony Bennett. Reese David asked Bennett if he would like to have Sampson, all 7 feet, 4 inches of him, suit up for his Cavaliers that evening against Duke. Deadpan Bennett said, "I'm not sure if I'd prefer to have Ralph Sampson suit up for us or to have Jay Billis suit up for Duke." Everyone on the set cracked up, but no one laughed harder than Jay did. Jay's been my go-to guy for quotes about local college basketball players for at least 15 years, maybe longer. I can call him on a Tuesday afternoon, ask him about the sixth man on a middle-of-the-road Big 12 team, and he'll know exactly how that guy is doing and what he needs to do to make a bigger impact. Jay is also not afraid to share controversial opinions, and he's got quite a platform with ESPN.com and on the air. Graduate of Duke Law School, he's a practicing attorney, and he's an advocate for student athletes' rights. Also the author of New York Times bestseller, Toughness, Developing True Strength on and Off the Court. So, Jay, welcome to Sports Connections.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
So here's your chance to brag. How good were you as a college player?
Good enough to play. That was about it. No, I had a great time playing. I was very fortunate to play with the guys I did and to play for the guy I played for. So I'm very grateful for the opportunity.
One of the things that strikes me about you, and like I mentioned in the intro, you and I've known each other for quite a while, is I don't know anybody who puts his own personal allegiances to the side better than you do. I remember one time we were talking about North Carolina, and I made kind of an offhanded joke that, well, you probably don't like North Carolina, and you responded that you have great respect for North Carolina. How hard is that to put your Duke jersey in the closet and root for college basketball in general?
I don't think it's hard at all. I don't think fair is difficult. I think unfair is difficult. So fair and is easy. And I think if you're looking at any game, any player, any team, and you can't say, well, this is the best player, this is the best team, then what are you worth? There are certain years where North Carolina is the best team. There are certain years where Duke's the best team. There are certain years like this one where neither one of them are close to being the best team.
Right.
And you just have to evaluate it. And if you're unwilling to, like, if you can't do that, then nothing you say is of any value. So I don't see how that's so hard. All of us went to school somewhere.
Yeah.
And I get it that Duke and Carolina are the two most successful programs, or at least among the most successful. And so, people tend to gravitate toward that, but I haven't been in college for 35 years. I don't wake up in the morning and go to bed thinking about, what my high school team did or what my college team did or what my, pro team did. It's just not, for me, it doesn't work that way. And honestly, I don't know that many people that it does work that way. You know, most of the people I work with a couple of exceptions, don't want to talk about where they went to school. It's not important. And it's not about them. It's not about us. It's about the current players and current coaches.
Now, after your playing career in Europe, you went back and coached at Duke. Did you see yourself as a coach long term, or was that something to keep you busy while you were going to law school?
No, I did see myself that way. The only reason I didn't stay in it was I got married, and my wife and I decided that for our family, that wouldn't be the best profession because of how long or how often we'd probably have to move.
Yeah.
And so it was more a family decision than anything, but I wanted very much to continue to coach. I just decided to do something different for the best interest of my family.
Sure. Now, watching you on ESPN for so many years, you look like you're having a great time, whether it's on SportsCenter, on game day, or broadcasting a game with Dan Shulman. Are you really having as much fun as it appears?
Yeah. Yeah. Because you get to go to games that otherwise you'd be paying to go to. I wouldn't, you know, if I was doing something else, I wouldn't go to games as often as I do now. And I wouldn't spend as much time. Like I wouldn't spend so much time watching film of teams and players and all that stuff. But the games, I'd still be just as excited to go to a ball game as I am now. And I do, you know, there is a lot of sort of pinching yourself in a way that I get to the, you know, literally the best seat in the house for these games, and they pay me to do it. That's kind of cool. Like the only thing about my job that I think is work is travel. I'm away a lot, and that wears on you. But you know, when I'm there, I enjoy every second of it. The only time that I'm, you know, when the buzzer goes off and the game's over, I'm ready to get on the plane and go home.
Yeah.
That's pretty much as soon as the buzzer goes off, I'm going, all right, now it's my time. Now anything that delays me from getting home is a little bit of a hindrance.
Do you have other funny stories, fun times from college game day? Like I'm sure you remember the one in Virginia that I alluded to in the introduction, where people made fun of you and you laughed harder than anybody. Do you have any other stories like that you want to share?
Yeah. I mean, when we go to Louisville and, you know, all the signs of Louisville beating us in the NCAA championship game or stuff with Purvis Ellison or you name it. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff. I mean, if you get to a point, like, look, I can sit with my teammates and guys that I played against and we can all, you know, have a couple beers and talk about how great we used to be, but most people don't care.
Yeah.
So it's just fun. And, you know, if you can't take a joke, what good are you? I enjoy the hell of it. And so what if I did, like, if I sit and talked about, you know, when I played, nobody cares about that. Whether you're national player of the year or you were just a decent player, it doesn't really matter. Nobody cares.
You know, I've got to ask you, you're obviously a practicing attorney. How do you find time to dig so deeply into college basketball? Not just the stars and the blue blood programs, but all throughout the country. I don't think I've ever stumped you when I called and said, hey, do you have 5 minutes? I need to ask you about a player. And then when we talk, I'll say, well, what about this guy who's coming off the bench at Iowa State or coming off the bench at Kansas State? How do you have that much time?
Well, basketball is my full-time job. So even though I'm still an active, you know, and licensed practicing attorney, I don't carry the caseload I did years ago. So, you know, this is my first job and I do some other things, but there during the basketball season, there's nothing that I allow to take time away, significant time away from the main gig, which is basketball. And over the years, I mean, I don't do as much summer scouting as I used to, just because I'm older and a little bit more established.
Yeah.
So I don't, you know, now time away from home, like my kids are gone, you know, they're adults now. So now when I leave home, I'm leaving my wife alone.
Yeah.
And that's not a comfortable feeling. You know, I used to leave her with the kids and that probably wasn't a comfortable feeling for her, but I don't like leaving her alone anymore. So, and she doesn't want to go, you know, to Augusta, Georgia and sit and watch the damn Peach Jam every summer. So I don't do as much of that, but I've spent my whole life, you know, studying the game and players and all that stuff. So I'm hopefully building off of a base of knowledge, but I cover this stuff, so I want to be up on it.
And, yeah.
So I spend a lot of time watching film and watching games, and then be going to practices and going to games and all that stuff. So I wind up seeing a lot of players, and I keep a pretty big database of scouting reports.
Sure. My favorite story with asking you a question and then the result of that, heading into the 2008-2009 season, K-State was heading into the first season without Michael Beasley and Bill Walker, and you weren't high on the Wildcats, and we all felt like Jake Pullen had a chance, but he obviously wasn't the Jake Pullen that he was at the end. And I reminded you that the year after Dominique Wilkins left Georgia, the year after he left, they reached the Final Four, and you quickly responded, well, Kansas State doesn't have Vern Fleming. A couple of days later, I ran into Coach Frank Martin at an event, and I told him what you said. I was recording him, and I just said, here's what Jay Billis had to say. And Frank's very colorful, and he said, well, Jay Billis. And I'm standing there, and I say, Frank, I'm recording this. Do you want to rephrase your answer? And he said, I beg to differ with Mr. Billis. And so I looked at him. I looked at him, and finally he just said, just say something in between those two and say that I said it. So do you get a lot of pushback from coaches about your assessment of their teams?
No, I don't. And you know, like, look, I expect coaches to stand up for their players. I don't have any problem with that. And Frank and I are good friends. Like, you know, he's spoken at my camp and all that stuff. So he said a lot worse to me in person. I don't have a problem with that. But you know, what are you going to do? Like, you know, you have an opinion on a team.
Yeah.
My opinion doesn't win or lose games for them. And so, you know, and by the way, I don't think they went to the Final Four that year. Did they?
No, they didn't. In fact, they made the NIT. I still think they should have gone to the NCAA. They finished fourth in the Big 12 ahead of Texas Tech, beat Texas Tech twice during the regular season and lost in the Big 12 tournament. And Texas Tech was coached by Bob Knight, and Texas Tech got in the tournament and K-State went to the NIT. You were right that K-State didn't have Vern Fleming and that they were a young team and developing and stuff. I didn't disagree with you, by the way.
It doesn't matter whether people agree or not. The point is, like, you know, everybody should say what they think, and you know, you have a basis for it. Like, sometimes you're right, sometimes you're not. But like, you know, I don't know who's going to win these games. You know, ESPN and the other outlets, they ask you to make picks.
Yeah.
But they do it because it pisses people off. You know, it gets people interested. And the truth is, a lot of people gamble on these games. And so that's being catered to as well. I don't have any problem with that. But if people think that we have a dog in the fight, like, I don't care. I don't care who's good or who's not. And frankly, I don't care which players are good or they're not. You watch them. Like, I really enjoy getting to know the players. Like, I love these guys. They're great. They're great men and great people. But you know, if you say, well, this guy's like, you know, sometimes fans are, and I get it. It's the way the world is, but like, somebody will say, all right, who's the best point guard, in the Big 12. And you'll say, well, Tyrese Halliburton. And then somebody else will go, well, what about so-and-so? Okay, he's second. Like, I didn't insult your player by saying this guy is the best player. And that's sort of the, and say, who's going to make the Final Four? You pick four teams and their team isn't in it and they're mad.
Yeah.
Well, that's fine. But you know, if you, like, I made this point to a Duke fan one time that I gave a speech at some Duke event. And I think it was just after the 2002 Final Four. And the guy had said, you said you picked Maryland to beat Duke last year in the Final Four last year. And I said, yeah, I did. And I said, well, that was a bad pick. And I said, well, yeah, I mean, Duke wound up winning. You're right.
Yeah.
And he said, well, that should teach you not to do that again. And I said, well, sir, how old are you? And he told, or I said, do you pick Duke every year to win the championship? And he says, yeah. And I said, well, how old are you? And he says, I'm 72 years old. And I said, well, congratulations. You're 4-60, you know, 68. You know, it doesn't make, if you're going to pick the same team every year just because you like them, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And that's not my job. My job is not to make you happy with the pick. My job is to tell you what I think, and then you can react to it. And that's all good stuff.
Yeah.
But But I don't have any problem with any fan, one, disliking me. That's fine. That's a matter of taste. You can like or dislike me all you want to. And I don't have any problem with a fan disagreeing. That's the good stuff. That's what we're supposed to do.
And you, I'm guessing you don't have any problem with a coach or a player disagreeing with your assessment.
No, that's fine. But you know, like that's the thing. Like when you have, but a lot of these guys have a dog in the fight. Like if you say, you know, so-and-so is going to make the Final Four, or this is the best team.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that your team can't win. Like what I say about you doesn't affect your play. And then, you know, sometimes there are players that'll use things as motivation or something and say, well, I'll show, you know, kind of the, I'll show you thing.
Yeah.
You're like, so if I didn't say anything, you wouldn't play as hard. Like, is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Like, it can't really be what you're saying. Or I'm going to really play hard in the NCAA tournament to show you, like, winning a championship is not enough. Or, I don't know. I never understood that. Like I was similar when I was a player. Everybody wants to be well regarded, but I didn't go into a game, you know, stepping onto the court going, all right, I have to show so-and-so because they said I wasn't as good as this guy. I never worked that way.
Do you enjoy engaging with the coaches or the players more?
Well, I don't rank it. I spend more time with coaches. And they're more of my contemporaries or peers, age-wise. So you're always going to spend more time with coaches. But I wind up getting to know a lot of these players. I get to know them in high school.
Yeah.
And heck, some of them I've worked with. You know, I used to do a lot of work with players. I don't do as much anymore just because I want more time in my summer than I used to. But I used to work camps every summer. I still have my own camp, but I used to work Nike Skills Academies. I worked with all the best players, summer after summer. I did it for a long time. And that was really helpful. More, you know, it was certainly helpful for, you know, college, but it was really helpful for the NBA draft, getting to see their skill level and be able to work with them on the floor.
One of my favorite segments, it's a short one each time, but is 94 feet with Jay Billis. How did that happen? Was that your idea? Was that a producer's idea? I just think it's great.
Yeah, it was collaborative. So our bosses probably 4 or 5 years ago challenged us to come up with some innovative things to take people deeper into the game. But it had to be, you know, we had to be conscious of time. Like, you just don't have as much time as you think, not only within games, but within studio shows and things like that. Things are time sensitive. So I work with a great producer named Scott Gustafson, and we had a game at Virginia one time. Villanova was playing Virginia, and we just decided, hey, what can we do? Like, let's accept this challenge we got from our bosses. Let's see if we can come up with something.
Yeah.
And I had seen on the NFL Network, I'd only seen it one time. It was during the NFL Combine, and it was called 40-Yard Dash. And I don't even remember who did it, but they walked 40 yards and did a little interview. And I mentioned that, and I said, why don't we fashion something like, and we'll do it the length of the court, 94, and we'll call it 94 feet. And so we did it. And the first one we did was with Jay Wright, oddly enough, when they were playing at Virginia. And it just kind of caught on. I don't know how, but it caught on, and it's just a fun thing. You know, the pandemic's obviously curtailed it, but it's just a fun little thing we've done.
Now, when you're doing that with the players, do they know, and I guess some of them probably more than others, they remember that you were a college basketball player, played with Duke and all that, or do they think you're just a tall commentator?
They have no, I don't know that any of them know I played. Nor should they, and nor should they care. I mean, I played, actually, I broadcast some of these guys, I broadcast games with their dads. And so like my son graduated a couple years ago from college, played at Wake Forest. And I played against his coach. So these guys have no idea, you know, kind of when you played, all that stuff. It was way before they were born.
Yeah.
And I'd worry about them if they cared about that. you know, like I didn't care, you know, I didn't care when I was playing that, you know, Coach K played at Army or all this stuff. That was ancient history to me. And I think it's the same for these players now, and it should be.
One of my favorite people in all of sports is Bill Walton. I got to know him when I wrote a book on UCLA basketball back in the late 1980s. one of the highlights to me of the early season each year is to watch you and Bill interact in Maui. How much of that is scripted and how much is just you guys being you guys?
None of it's scripted, because I don't think Walton would tolerate a script. He usually, before we go on the air on things, if we're talking about something, he'll stop the conversation and say, let's save it for the air, you know, stuff like that. And his thing is, say whatever you want. Like you don't worry about my feelings. And I tell him the same thing. He's a gem. Like, he's such a wonderful human being. And I think he's one of the, conservatively, one of the five best college players that's ever played. And yeah. I think he is in a short list of one of the best big men that have ever played the game, period. And I think because of injuries he had as a pro and the fact he played so many years with the San Diego Clippers, not as many young people are up on, you know, the championship he won with Portland and just how great he was before his feet let him down. But what a magnificent person he is, and generous. I think people sometimes get caught up in some of the fun that he has and don't, you know, they don't realize the substance that's under some of the showmanship, because there's a tremendous amount of substance. He knows the game like very few others, and just a wonderful, wonderful person. I love him. Absolutely love him.
Yeah. He is unique, and that's an overused expression, which is kind of oxymoronic in itself, but he definitely is a unique individual. Tell me about your book. How did that happen? Did you bring up the idea, or did somebody bring it to you?
Well, it's a great question. When I was watching a game, I don't even remember the game, but I was watching a game one day, and a commentator like me had praised the actions of a player that I thought was just being a bully. Calling that player tough. And I was like, no, that's not what tough means. And for some reason I don't want to say it rankled me, but it kind of motivated me to say, no, that's not what it is. And so I wrote an article for ESPN.com on what toughness means in basketball. And I wasn't asked to do it by my editor. I was moved by that one incident. And I don't know what it was that kind of lit a fire under that, but I wrote the article, I submitted it and said, look, I don't know if you guys want this or not, but I was moved to write it, and they liked it and they packaged it and put it on the site. And the response to it was, I couldn't believe it. I mean, literally all over the world, I was getting feedback from military leaders, teachers, coaches in different sports, you parents, you name it. And so my wife came up with the idea. She said, you know, there's something here. You need to write a book on this. And so I thought about it, and I came up with the idea, not the idea, because the idea was there, but came up with the what I wanted it to look like. And then, you know, sort of sold it. It got a literary agent, you know, that world. Yeah. I did. Yeah. And so it was a great exercise. But you know how it is when you write a book that happens to be successful, they want you to write another one. And nothing so far has moved me like that to go through that again. So I haven't taken on a second one.
Okay. That was my follow-up is, you know, do you have another book in you? And we'll just have to wait and see on that. Everyone knows you're not afraid to speak your opinion. And that's one of the things that makes you so enjoyable to listen to as you're doing games and things like that. Let me tee up a couple of questions and I'll go one at a time. First one is, what's right about college basketball?
Almost everything. College basketball is great. But I, you know, it's funny, David, I don't really look at college basketball as being this entity that is different from the rest of the game. I mean, I look at it as basketball, and it does have different levels. So you could say, okay, high school basketball, college basketball, pro basketball, you know, all that stuff, international. But I think it's just one game. And I refer to it, you'll hear a lot of people say, well, our game, that has no place in our game, or this is our game. I don't, for some reason that's always rubbed me the wrong way. Like, nobody has ownership over this game. You know, we may be in positions of caretaking of the game.
Yeah.
But I look at it as the game. And so for me, college basketball is great. High school basketball is great. There are aspects of it that can be improved. And there are certainly things that are wrong with it. But that's true of anything. Like you could say, heck, you know, the United States is great. Like, what's wrong with the United States? Well, overall, nothing. Conceptually, all these, but we have some things we have to improve upon.
Yeah.
Like, we got a long way to go to live up to the ideals we have. And I think college basketball is, to use that as an analogy, is similar. Like, I think college sports in general have a long way to go to live up to the ideals that we espouse. And we're not doing that. And I think if, especially through the pandemic, it's laid it bare. There's no reasonable, intelligent person that can with a straight face say that this is not a multi-billion dollar entertainment industry.
Right.
There are great things that come from it, but we'd be fooling ourselves and lying to ourselves and to the public if we said anything, but that doesn't mean there are not great benefits to it. And it's not fantastic. But the idea that we played this season to give the kids, we love to infantilize players, to give the kids an opportunity to compete. We did this for money. Yeah. And there are a lot of benefits to doing that beyond money, but we're doing this for one reason, and we're doing it for money, and that's okay.
Yeah.
But it's also, we have to admit it.
Yeah. Well, you answered my second question, so I'll move on to the next one. The NCAA obviously does not have a commissioner. University presidents run the NCAA, but if there was a commissioner position and they approached you about taking the role, would you become the NCAA commissioner?
They would never do that. But I would do anything, David, that I could to help. Like, I'll give you an example. Like, right now I'm on the NCAA's competition committee. And so that committee deals with the actual rules of play. So, okay. You know, the rules on the floor, and we make recommendations to that are data-based and well-considered. We make recommendations to the rules committee, and the rules committee makes whatever changes to the rules. Sometimes there's no change, but and I think a lot of my bosses at first thought that might be, hey, is this a conflict of interest? No, I'm not comfortable with this. I'm like, look, I think it's service to the game. And so I've done it, and I've enjoyed every minute of it. It's a collaborative process that I think has been great. So I would serve in whatever capacity would help. But as you know, college sports, people tend to look at the NCAA like it's the NBA or the NFL. Really what college sports is, the NCAA just controls, the basketball tournament and sets eligibility rules and really serves as a kind of an umbrella for all these different leagues. Like the SEC is its own NFL and NBA.
Right.
And the ACC is its own NFL and NBA. They make all their own rules. They control all their own money. The Ivy League, all these, they're all their own NBA and NFL. And the NCAA just kind of oversees that. And operates as the mechanism that keeps the players from making any money. Frankly, that's its greatest service to all the members, is that they you know, sort of that structure allows all of these different leagues to operate like the NBA and like the NFL, but not have to pay for its labor. That's really what we've got. We've got a bunch of different media rights consortiums that operate under the umbrella of the NCAA. So it in one regard, having a commissioner, I think would help, having a commissioner of college basketball, just to, so you could have a little bit, you could move with some deliberate speed and you're not constantly having to react to things, which we do now. We're way behind the times. And so what, you know, short answer, would I do it? Yes. But there'd have to be a lot of structural changes for me to do it, because I wouldn't do it under the current form. Right now, you know, the NCAA president is just a figurehead that makes excuses for not being able to do things. I think Mark Emmert or whoever's in that position at a given time can have a lot of influence, but chooses not to in a lot of areas.
Maybe you don't want to answer this, but I'll ask it anyway. You can always say, hey,
I'll answer anything. I'm fine.
Coach Humphrey Lake, let's say the structure was changed and they said, okay, our first commissioner is Jay Billis. What's the first executive order you would sign?
Well, I would eliminate amateurism and allow the players to have rights, economic rights. Really, when you think about it, it's unconscionable that the only students, the only people, including students, so it's the only student that is told what they can earn or accept in the marketplace by virtue of being a student.
Yeah,
and it's unbelievable that we do that. And even right now in the debate over name, image, and likeness, which the NCAA said they would never entertain, now they're entertaining it because they said it was an existential threat. Like, how could you provide it if it's an existential threat? It never made any sense to me. And I think they're going to have to answer that, frankly, before the Supreme Court, too. But to me, we start with, okay, you get nothing. The players get nothing. And then let's all talk about what will allow the players over nothing instead of, no, it should be, you get everything. And let's talk about if we need a reasonable restriction here or there, that's narrowly tailored, that's going to benefit the entire enterprise. Because when you think about it, and I have, there's not one single spending control in college sports,
right?
There's no spending control on coaches' salaries, on the size of athletic departments or facility spending, what they spend on travel, what they spend on food, anything, what they spend on recruiting. Spend whatever you want. The only wage ceiling or spending control is on players. And to me, that's wrong to the point of being immoral when we're dealing with a multi-billion dollar business like this.
I remember when Stacey Augmon, a former UNLV star, went to the NBA, and after his first season, somebody asked him, what's the difference between playing at UNLV and playing in the NBA, he said, I wasn't used to a salary cap. Great. One of the great quotes. I'm going to change the subject a little bit lighter. I've done a book with Joe Lunardi. What's your opinion of Joe Lunardi? He has made a career out of predicting what somebody else is going to do, and he's really good at it. What's your thoughts on Joe?
It's fantastic. I mean, it's fantastic. I mean, it's been such a fun thing to be able to talk about for people to say, well, is my team in or out? Or what does this game mean coming up? I think people can argue things as far as interest. But, like a lot of what's happened over the last probably 20 years has put basketball in a position where there's so much, everything's riding on the tournament.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people say, well, I mean, why should I pay attention to the regular season? It's almost like they think the regular season doesn't mean anything. I don't think that's true. But we have put a lot on the tournament, but I think there's more interest in the regular season than ever. And this year is a little bit different because of the pandemic, right? But there's more interest in the tournament than ever. I used to laugh when people would say, well, I liked it better in the old days when you watch these teams play and all that. And I go, you knew all the players, they stayed longer. And I'm going, the old days, what are you talking about? Like in the 70s, there was literally, there was literally one game on a week. Like they called it the game of the week for a reason.
Yeah.
There was only one game on.
Yeah.
And, so you had no choice. You watched that game and it was either UCLA versus Notre Dame or DePaul versus Notre Dame or something like that. You watch the same teams over and over again. And you'll remember this, David, like in the late 70s, the overwhelming majority of basketball fans around the country could not have picked Larry Bird out of a lineup until the Final Four, until the Final Four in 79. Nobody knew who he was. And so now, with the advent of television and every game being on TV now, people consume the product at a higher rate than ever. So I don't buy this stuff at all. And it's about your question about Joe and Jerry Palm and all these bracketology guys that, I think interest is enhanced by that. And even though we're talking about the end all the time, like I heard somebody on the radio today saying, just give us March Madness now. I don't think they really mean that.
Yeah.
But we're just more of a football-centric society. We love football, And even though there are only a handful of teams every year that we know are going to be competitive for the national championship, only a handful, and that's being generous.
Yeah.
We love football. And so it's, it, you know, basketball, we love the tournament. We love the upsets and we love the bracket. But most fans couldn't, you know, they say they want to watch Cinderella, but they really don't.
Yeah.
Because the ratings prove that they don't.
Yeah. This year is unique in a lot of ways. One of those ways is the fact that Blue Bloods are struggling. I looked at Joe's bracketology this morning, and Kentucky's out of the tournament. Duke's out of the tournament. Not even on the bubble right now. Carolina's hanging on by a thread. Michigan State's out. Kansas, in my neck of the woods, they're solidly in, but they're running the risk of not being in the top four seed for the first time in 20 years. Why do you think the Blue Bloods are struggling so much this year?
I think it's just an odd confluence of events. You know, Kansas is going through an NCAA issue, and that has badly hurt recruiting. I don't think there's any question about that. And North Carolina is lost. They have lost a lot of really good players over the last couple of years. They're still very good. They're just young. They have really young guards. So it's unusual that Roy Williams would have that kind of youth at the same time in the backcourt,
right?
Which he has this year. And Duke and Kentucky have the number one and number two recruiting classes in the country, which they've had every year since 2010.
Yeah,
when John Calipari got there. And this is the first year that they've underperformed. You know, it's just odd. And there's no real explanation for it. I'm sure there's some, you know, aspect of COVID that has been a part of this. But I think they're just, you know, like Jalen Johnson's a great prospect. He's just not having a very good year. He's been injured and he's back and he's not been good overall.
Yeah.
He's at least as good as his reputation and potential and talent. And same's true of the Kentucky guys. They're good, but they're not really good.
Yeah.
And but if it were like, I think what we're seeing right now are a lot of people that their sensibilities are offended by one and done. They've always made value judgments on it. And so they're taking this one data point of this year and trying to turn it into a trend by saying, see, one and done doesn't work.
Yeah.
One and done doesn't work. When the truth is, I don't care whether you take the last 5 years, last 10 years, whatever. The two teams that have won the most NCAA tournament games and the most regular season games are Duke and Kentucky. And you know, like if you go back 6 years, they were both in the Final Four and Kentucky won 38 games. Duke won the national championship in 2015. They've been to more Elite Eights, more Sweet 16s, all of it. So the idea that experience matters, of course it does. Like I've never gotten onto a plane where they said, came over the loudspeaker and says, hey, listen, we got a new pilot for you. First flight, but boy, a lot of potential. really think this pilot's going to be great. And I felt great about it. Of course not. Experience is always better. But you can't deny that these teams have won at the highest level and they have knocked on the door of the Final Four in the national championship more than anyone else.
Yeah.
And if experience would trump those two teams every time, and you'd see a whole bunch of teams in the Elite Eight and Final Four more than them, and you're not seeing that. So this is an anomaly. And look, if it goes on year after year after year, maybe we'll say, but it's funny. I don't hear anybody saying, you know, Coach K and Calipari can't do it anymore. They've lost it. And what about like, there's another blue blood you didn't mention. Michigan State's got older players. They're getting their ass kicked too.
Yeah.
And so how do we process that? Like, do we say, well, wait a minute, like they've got older players and they're losing. They've got the same record as those other teams. And they're getting like, they've been getting drubbed lately. Lost to Rutgers by 30.
Yeah.
Run out by Ohio State. You know, they play Iowa coming up. So how do we process that? What's the narrative there? I don't know what it is about one and done that gets people so rankled. Cause my thing is if you don't, the easy thing is if you don't want one and done players, don't recruit them. Then you don't have to worry about it.
Yeah.
The people that should question it are Duke fans and Kentucky fans, but they don't like it. If they don't like it, fine. But you know, I didn't hear anybody saying this Zion Williamson thing is not going to work out. It's just not going to work out. I said, Zion Williamson didn't play in a Final Four. Yeah, that's right. He got to the Elite Eight, and Cassius Winston hit a shot at the buzzer to you know at the end of the game to put them in it. You know, is that's what we're going to parse is got the Elite Eight and one bucket away. I don't buy that.
Yeah. How much do you think the lack of a home court advantage plays in? Because like, you know, teams go into Kansas now and are not quite as threatened. Kansas still has a good team, good program, good history, good coach, great coach, but they don't have the crowd right on them. Do you think that the lack of a home court advantage is playing much into it?
Maybe a little bit, but not enough. I mean, I think what's playing into it is they're not the same bodies in that Kansas uniform that played in front of those crowds. And it sounds horribly disrespectful to the current Kansas players, but I don't think anybody could look at this year's team and say it's anywhere near as good as last year's, anywhere near as good as the number one seed teams he's had. And, you know, this Baylor team is really good. But I think if you put this Baylor team in another year when Kansas had its normal team, it'd be a fist fight. I mean, it would not be it's a foregone conclusion who's going to be the Big 12 champion this year. It's not close. But usually that's been Kansas. And this year it's Baylor.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons is because Kansas isn't there. And, you know, like I've heard this about Baylor too. And I'm a huge fan of Baylor. I love this team. I love their program. I think Scott Drew has done one of the best jobs, not only in college basketball, but in college basketball history with that program. It's unbelievable what he's done. But it's not like with all the experience they have and the way they've done it and the model they've used and what people like to call process, not like they've got a bunch of Final Fours they've been tacking up.
Right.
Now I think they will this year, but it sort of goes to the point that there are a lot of different ways to do it and win. And, you know, if people don't like the one and done thing, it's one. And Syracuse won with Carmelo Anthony.
Right.
You know, like when was the last time UCLA got to a Final Four? When Kevin Love was playing there.
Yeah.
You know, when was the last time LSU got there? When they had Tyrus Thomas and Tasman Mitchell and they were all freshmen was the last time they got there. It has worked. And, you know, super talent can beat experience at times.
Last basketball question for you. Who is this year's San Diego State or Dayton?
I don't know. I don't know that we necessarily have one. Like Drake is unbeaten and they're very good. I've seen them play several times, but I don't get the same feeling watching them that I did watching Dayton last year. I don't know, David, this is a really weird year. There's been some really good out there. I haven't been blown away by a lot of teams. And that's one of the reasons I think Gonzaga and Baylor are head and shoulders above everybody else. One, they're really good.
Yeah.
But they've not gotten a bunch of resistance. And within their own leagues, like I don't think St. Mary's, I don't think the West Coast Conference is anywhere near as good as it's been in the past overall. Right. They've got some good players, but they don't have some of the teams that they've had in the past. And the Pac-12 is not great. I think the Big Ten and the Big 12 are really good. The ACC is nowhere near what it has been, nowhere near what it has been. And I think you could say the same thing about the Big East. Like right now, Villanova is only one loss. Now they've been on COVID pause. They're good. They're good. I think if you put a little truth serum in Jay Wright and said, where would this team rank among your five best teams in the last decade? He'd go sixth.
Hmm.
Like I've had five better teams than this. Now that doesn't mean that this team doesn't have one of the best chances of any of his teams to win it because of this year.
Yeah.
But it's an odd year. And hopefully because of the fact that we've gotten off such a slow start, you know, didn't have exhibition games, didn't have practices and all that stuff. Maybe this month, some of these teams will take off that I'm talking about, like Michigan or whatever. Iowa will start defending better and they'll be better. Illinois will be more consistent. Maybe that's what'll, or Wisconsin, maybe that'll happen.
Yeah.
But this Wisconsin team is really good. It's not as good as the one they had that went the Final Four in 2014, 2015. That Wisconsin team would hammer this one.
Yeah. I lied. One more basketball question. How cool would it be to have an undefeated Baylor and an undefeated Gonzaga meet in the national championship?
Be great. What would be better is if we allowed them to play a five-game series. You know, it's so funny that – you know, I mean, this year we did a thing on game day, and who knows whether we're right or wrong, but The question was, do you want Gonzaga and Baylor or the field to win the title? And, you know, the easy thing to do is say, well, I'll take Gonzaga or Baylor. But it's kind of like trying to pick – I'm a big golf fan. It's kind of like trying to pick the winner of the Accenture Match Play Championship.
Yeah.
You know, like you got a better shot of picking who's going to win the Masters because you got four rounds and you got a total score. When you're doing match play, man, anybody can win those matches. And you feel the same way about the NCAA tournament. Now, I actually felt that the odds were with the field this year, even as good as Baylor and Gonzaga are against the field. Because, you know, you might stub your toe in a six game. You got to win six to win the title. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's an odd – and COVID's going to be a factor. It's just going to be a factor. I don't see us getting through the tournament without it being a factor. And I hope I'm wrong.
Yeah.
Like, I hope that nothing happens. But, man, I'm really bothered by the fact that everybody went full steam ahead into this season. And now we're having so many people talk about, well, let's not play our conference tournament because we don't want to take any risk before we get to the NCAA tournament. That's just a weird approach to me.
Yeah.
Maybe it's valid. I'd like to explore it more and talk about it, but it's really odd.
All right. Off of basketball, I always like to let my guests talk about family. I know you've got several kids. I know your son played at Wake Forest. Just talk about your family.
I've been married for 28 years. Met my wife Wendy in college. She's a professional artist, and very proud of her, not only who she is, but what she does. And then we have two kids, a 26-year-old girl, she's a woman, who's also a professional artist and a very accomplished horse rider. She competes in hunter jumper competitions around the country. And she's very, very talented. And then our son works for the NBA. Now he works on the junior NBA program. He's a junior employee there. He played basketball growing up and played a bunch of sports, but he played in high school and was a good player in high school. And then was a walk-on and captain of the team at Wake Forest his senior year, playing for Danny Manning. And really proud of both my kids. They're such, I really admire them, obviously love them, but really admire them and what they're about. My wife and I have kind of enjoyed watching them become adults and kind of following them around now. And we're grandparents to our daughter's dog. And it's kind of a lot of fun being our age right now.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm a grandparent to two granddaughters. And there is nothing like it. I could be having the worst day imaginable. And those two little girls, 5 and 3, come running through the front door, "Grandpa," and every day, everything's perfect. So I don't know how soon that'll be, but look forward to that day, my friend.
I'm looking forward to it. Thank you.
Last question. What is in the future for Jay Billis?
That's a good question. Hopefully getting out of the house more often. I've never in my adult life had a goal of the next thing. Like I've not really said, okay, well in 10 years I want to be here. My dad years ago said something to me that I've always remembered. He said, if you want to get a job, do the job you have. And so I've really thought about, you know, one, I'm very grateful for and don't want to take for granted the job that I have now because I truly do love it. But you know, I've never said that I wouldn't consider another opportunity. I always will, but I can't imagine anything being better than what I'm doing now. The only thing, and I don't mind saying this, I'm 57 years old. The only thing I don't mind thinking about is there's going to come a day when I'm going to want to slow down. And I'm going to want to say to my wife, it's, you get to choose now, whatever you want. And whatever she wants, I'm going to do because she's sacrificed for me and us, meaning our family and our kids and me. So whenever she says enough, it's going to be enough. And there's going to come a time where I'm going to walk away from this, wanting to do something else that's not work. And I'm not going to hesitate to do that. And I've thought, I, I don't like, you know, kind of presenting that, oh, there's going to come a day where I'm going to retire or something like that. Like it's some Pollyanna thing, but it's more, I'm going to, whatever my wife wants to do, we're doing.
How are your painting skills? Your art skills?
Lousy. My art consumption skills are great because usually one of the best art, my wife had an art show one time. She was at a gallery. She was showing at a gallery up in the mountains of North Carolina in the Grandfather Mountain, Linville area. And I, you know, I was going to this thing and had to be the dutiful, you know, artist spouse and, you know, really proud, obviously. But after a while, you know, I've seen all my wife's work. After a while, you know, I was going, what am I going to do? And Hugh Durham's wife is a huge art collector. Huh. And so he was there and we sat in the back of this art show having a few beers talking basketball. And I told my wife, I go, if Hugh Durham's going to be there, I'll go to any art show you want. Like, if I get to do that's awesome. Yeah. We had the best time. Just wonderful.
All right. Well, I appreciate your time, Jay. It's always good to catch up with you. And I thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Sports Connections with David Smail. Make sure to subscribe, follow, and rate the show from your favorite podcast platform. You can learn more about David Smail and his work by visiting davidsmailbooks.com. Don't forget to join us weekly for new episodes. Until next time.